Welcome to NeuroNoodles Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jake Gunkelman. He's the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans, and Dr. Marie Swingle, author of iMinds. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you.
Jay, I think we got Dr. Nolan here.
All right.
He's another Canadian. Hey.
Well, I saw that, you know, is yeah.
Dr. Marie will have a friend.
Well, you know, North Dakota, the water flows north to Hudson Bay. They probably should have been part of Canada in the first place, you know. So
Dr. Hello, hello. Nolan Bice.
Good
Did
morning.
I say that right? Bice?
Spicy. Yeah,
close. Spicy.
Yeah.
You Canadians, man. I can't get your names right to save my life. Speaking of Canadians, here comes another one. Dr. Marie Swingle. Wonder what country she's chiming in from.
I don't know.
She was in Slovenia last week, so...
That meeting's got to be over.
Yeah.
And our second favorite Canadian on the show is Dr. Marie Swingle.
Hello, and I understand, hello, neighbor.
Hi, neighbor.
Dr. Hey, Nolan Bicey. Bicey. Yes, exactly. Did I get it right?
Okay. Perfect. Yeah, nailed it.
Aren't you going to say something, Dr. Marie?
Good morning.
you're going to poke fun at my dialect? You're going to discriminate?
Oh, later. There's lots of time for that.
So,
Nolan, I hope you're aware and prepared for the, shall we say, extreme camaraderie on the show.
I'm sure it'll be great. Yeah.
Okay.
We aspire to be good enough. So, Dr. Nolan Bicey, you have a device. You have a company called Circle Brain. Mm-hmm. We were notified about you. You looked interesting. We checked you out. You can do a better job of selling yourself than me. Could you give us your background, please?
Sure. Well, I started off life as a researcher and ended up dissecting rat brains for years, doing a PhD out of the University of Toronto in biochemistry and focused on the neuroscience of the brain, and realized very quickly that dissecting rat brains was not for me. And so ended up working on funding research innovation for companies to figure out how they connect to, you know, academic expertise. And I sort of bridged that gap and started to understand the things that companies needed from the smart people in universities and the type of problems they faced, found it compelling and interesting, and then somehow ended up founding a company, my first brain health company. And that company built software for academic researchers to answer questions about brainwaves at scale. So we worked with NASA and we worked with some pro sports teams and had a really good time. Ultimately, that company didn't end up lasting, but it gave me a taste of entrepreneurship. So I got pretty excited about it. And since then, I've been looking at different other aspects about brain health. I've been fascinated about it for years and ended up building Circle, where we build a different type of headset that is purpose-built to understand how your brain is changing and to change the trajectory of neurological injuries. So the one thing that we don't understand about our brains is that they're changing over time and our normal follows that change. So as you go from, you know, a really healthy brain to a moderately healthy brain to maybe a level of concern where you're impinging or getting close to chronic fatigue or burnout or even PTSD, you have no real sense of that until you are in a bad place. And so our point is to catch that trajectory early on and help you figure out how are you changing to, you know, improve your brain and understand what that improvement looks like.
I'm going to
jump right on in, Nolan, in terms
of the science. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's jump right in. Like, how are you determining the difference between a long, hard day or a long, hard week and the, which you'll flip the following week versus the beginning of burnout?
Yeah, so it's time and it's how you change over time. So it's a great question. So if you're measuring fatigue with a headset, so I'll back up before I answer your question, Marie.
Yep.
So the thing that our headset does is it gives you visual stimulus through an iOS device. And what we measure is the difference between you to pay attention to control stimuli. So when your brain says, "I don't care about that information," to something that stimulates your brain, and your brain says, "What was that? And does that matter for my continued survival?" So you guys are all wearing shirts, but your brain is not telling you, "Hey, I'm wearing a shirt every 2 seconds," because the information doesn't matter for you. So we provide stimulation like your shirt, and then we do something new, and we measure how much of your brain pays attention to the new thing that you just did. So to answer your question, is that measure of brain activity by the electrical activity of neurons firing, directly relates to fatigue, exactly like you say. So if you measure your brain over the course of the day, you'll start at a higher level and you'll decrease over time. If you measure yourself from a week, on Monday, you'll start, at about, say, 80% of your brain health if you're doing good. And on Friday, you'll be about half of that just from working all week, even if you slept great. And so fatigue changes on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. But if your average brain level keeps dropping, then that starts to get into chronic fatigue, starts to get into longer term things. If it continues to drop even further, then you can start to head towards burnout. And so the whole point of the technology is to figure out what's your normal range and when are you outside of it. And if you're outside of it, is that a temporary thing where you're just exhausted? Or did you have a concussion? Or are you trending down to the point where you might have an issue that needs to be dealt with?
Okay, a follow-up question for you.
Yeah.
For better, for worse, most of us, I mean, I'm an active therapist. Most people do not knock on your door for preventative therapy. They knock on your door, they pick up an app when they think something is up.
Yeah.
So, in terms of establishing baselines, I mean, of course, we're talking about stochastics here, but how do you differentiate, or is there a means to differentiate the starting point from a brain health point?
So the way to do that is to build a population size data set where it's just like blood pressure, right? You just say, I can one-off measure your brain and say that based on all the U's in the world, that you're this percentile score. And we do that now, and we will give you a percentile score if you use the technology, but I wouldn't say that that is a sort of a diagnostic representative of how healthy your brain is, because we just don't have enough data at this point. Like that would take, it's a guess, but at least 100,000 different people before we could say with any, level of credibility that you're good or you're bad.
Good. I think we'll slide into Jay with the questions.
Jay Gunkelman, your thoughts?
I suspect that the number is more like 500,000. And right now, I've been approached by a number of AI trying to replace psychiatry, and they got access to lots of EEGs. The difficulty is that these are clinical EEGs, which are epilepsy and encephalopathy, and they don't have autism, they don't have depression, they don't have ADD, they don't have all, I mean, there's all of the panoply of psychiatry has to be in that modeling. Otherwise, you don't really have the population sampled. And I simply looked back at 500,000 EEGs I had already seen and came up with my recollection of 11 common patterns that I thought were like foundational patterns. They repeat so often. And I identified two of them as having known genetic correlates, and we suggested the other nine were candidate endophenotypes. We just didn't know the genetic linkage. Since then, they've identified all those genetic links. Johnson & Johnson did some expensive genotyping and came up with that data. But it's going to take a huge number. They've already got hundreds of thousands in some of the collections that have been made. But again, Stanford University was really early on in the project, and they thought it was great because they had a 37,000 archive already digitized and ready to go, and they came quite quickly to say, well, we see it's like all epilepsy and some dementia cases and a couple coma type cases, and but they're that we don't really have psychiatry represented, and that's the unfortunate circumstances that the population of studies that they have been directed by the limitations placed on them by the practice of EEG, which has devolved from the 40s and 50s, where it was broadly used in psychiatry as well by neurology. But at this point, in the 60s and 70s, they reduced it down to things that you could diagnose. And the psychiatric stuff was too nonspecific to end up continuing. So that aspect of EEG just went away. And unfortunate. I found that aspect of EEG to be quite fascinating, actually, and studied with the masters of that era. So I'm familiar with the neuropsychological aspect of EEG function, not just the neurological things most people see.
I was going to jump in there and talk about how, you know, Nolan, we bat back and forth in a really positive way, ensuring that our audience knows whether we're talking about clinical databases versus normative databases, et cetera. Which one are you basing your baselines off of? Are you going from how close you are to the normative or the melting pool, or a cleaner normative base, or a clinical base, or are you working with both of them?
Right. So the main way our headset provides value is just comparing you to yourself. Yeah. Because right now comparing you to a general population is not useful. The technology, the methodology that we use, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, is called a visually evoked potential. It's been around since the 60s. And because it's been around for so long, it correlates with everything in terms of the academic literature. And so, you know, to go back, you had a really interesting point before, Marie, is people don't typically spend money on preventative medicine, or at least, you know, not $1,000. Yeah. And so we are not going to be working with people that, even though I think early onset dementia is and early dementia detection is really valuable to the population. I mean, it's a $500 billion problem per year in the States. I think really where we offer value is working with first responders and people who have an acute and recurring need, where they see things every single day that is challenging for them. And in our conversations with them, we are seeing every single time we talk to them that there is a great need here. And so the whole point is, how do we build our product so that we can help them solve this hair on fire problem? Mm-hmm. And the technology that we use in terms of understanding your question in terms of how we understand their data set is an evolving point. We're just going to have to see what way the analysis works for them to understand the physiological relevance of the measurements that we're seeing. So it is critical for us to first off measure brain accurately. And then the next thing is, well, what does that mean? And how can that be predictive, both in terms of how you're heading towards a potential brain health concern or how you're healing from a brain health concern, and to validate what tactics might work for you.
I'm going to throw in a compliment and then a critique. The compliment is, thank you for your transparency. I really love it when people come on and they want to share their new tech or their products, that they're transparent about things. The second is, you've picked up on Pete's mispronunciation of my name. So here it comes. It's Mari, actually, not Marie.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
We blame it all on Pete. It's the running joke for over a year.
Your device is a dry sensor, or okay? And are you interested in the EEG or the ERP primarily?
Well, the EEG causes an ERP.
Yeah, I know, but are you tracking the EEG primarily with? I mean, I've seen.
So the short answer is both, because I think that the continuous raw EEG data is useful as additional information in addition to the ERP. So the ERP, there's a ton of, as you know, there's over 10,000 research articles describing ERPs and the nuances of the grand average waveform associated with it. But the raw data and the power spectral density across the frequency range of EEG is also interesting and useful, as I'm sure you know.
I have seen people use dry sensors with not a very good amp, and the EEG is noisy, but the EEG randomizes out and ERP is looking good. That's so right. my question was basically, you know, is this dry sensor, not really looking at EEG and getting a good ERP out of some noisy data. But it sounds like you're actually looking at the power spectra as well, which means yes. The amp has to be more stable and higher quality. Dry sensors are sometimes have contact difficulties.
Yep.
Some of them are covered with a polymer. Some of them are covered with a material with the silver chloride deeper in the deal. How are you maintaining better contact than just solid metal?
It's a wonderful question. So to make sure that the impedance of the electrode, so how they connect to your scalp, allows us to collect good data reliably, there's two critical things that we've done. The first thing that when we build the headset, we didn't add a bunch of sensors. Now, if I was to build my favorite headset, I would have two sensors down the midline of your head and your front, your motor cortex, and the back parietal part of your head. We just put two sensors at the parietal part of your head. So these guys sit at the crown of your head and that's it. So when you put it on, you give them a little wiggle, you can feel the coolness. And as soon as you can feel the coolness electrodes, we know from measurement and doing this hundreds and hundreds of times that the impedance is good enough to get a clean signal from your head, or as clean as a gold dry electrode will get. The other thing we do is
So you probably have a very high input impedance. So yes, contact impedance becomes relatively irrelevant, even a, you know, from 10 to 100 it ends up being an acceptable, you know, if you're not below 10, if you're not below 5, you don't really meet 5K ohms of resistance. You don't really meet clinical standards for recordings according to ASSET, but 10 will work fine. And in dry sensors with a very high input impedance, up to 100 ends up still giving you a very nice signal. So
I will say, though, Jay, just to add, is we do use electrode paste as well. So you put a little bit on the electrodes, and our digital signal processing is good enough that we don't need to use it. But because I'm a research scientist, I want the data to always be as clean and as useful as possible. So we use it. And one of the things when we were designing the product is anybody ever going to use that? If we tell them to put paste on it, and we thought, well, no, nobody's going to use it. But in the markets that we're looking at now, it's not an issue. So we advocate for everybody to put a little dab of paste on everything before you use it.
Yeah. There are other companies that have a little spritz of water on, and just enough to moisten a kind of a cloth interface. There's different. As long as it's not solid metal with a contact jitter, you know, you've solved that problem with your device. And I have to say that you're essentially dabbling into brain computer interface type material. Are you doing anything with the data where the data would end up doing something other than provide information?
What do you mean in terms of like controlling things like a BCI?
Brain computer interface, quite often the brain controls the mouse or some device, that sort of thing. Are you oriented toward that? You used BCI in your in some of your material describing some of your background. So,
we're not going that way right now. There are some other companies that are doing it in terms of helping like nonverbal autistic people or people who have speech difficulties be able to speak through this technology, through EEG technology. I think that's really a really cool application, but that's not where we're focused now. Yeah,
actually, G-Tech sponsors a BCI contest or workshop. Free every year. Yesterday they put out the notice of the 2024 BCI hackathon, and they put out a very nice prize. You get a you actually get a bread knife that has EEG on the knife. From Gert Furcheller's event-related synchronization, desynchronization, the first EEG recorded with him imagining cutting bread. And they turned that into a bread knife, vanadium tungsten blade, a 200-year-old olive handle, €650 for the knife if you wanted to buy one. But that's the gift for the along with other prizes, but that's the top prize. I happen to have one here. I bought serial number one off of them back when they first made them.
Gifts only geeks appreciate.
Oh yeah, you know, I mean, but you know, actually, Martijn Arns visited, and I showed it to him, and he handled the knife. And if you know anything about a fine knife blade, if you put a fingerprint on it, that's not something you're supposed to have done. You know, I should have wiped it off, but it's got his fingerprints on it now. So if ever something happens to me, you know, you can
we'll edit this out in post.
Martijn Arns fingerprints are on this knife. And now at this point you can see them because, you know, over time, you'll see fingerprints get a little bit of a buildup on top of them. So,
Nolan anyway, and panel, can we denerdify things?
Yeah, sure.
What?
Okay, so let's just take my mom, who is worried about dementia.
Yeah,
she's buying all these puzzle books that say, "Oh, this will, you know, keep your brain sharp and whatnot." She trips over and falls onto your website, which is marketed towards dementia as well. How does your product help my mom get from point A to point B? If it's not that type of product, like what does it do? Because I'm thinking about product placement and the waves that you're picking up on. How is she going to be better off today than yesterday if she spent $1,000 for your product?
Yeah, good question. So the way we measure your brain, it produces what we've been throwing around as an ERP or an event-related potential. And that measurement from 21 years to 80 years stays roughly the same. So if you have a healthy brain, the number that is your brain, which is personalized to you, should be flat for the majority of your life. Now, if you start to develop dementia, those changes in your brain start to happen up to 20 years before you have a functional diagnosis of dementia, at which point you've lost 60% of your brain. And so what happens with this value, this ERP measurement, is instead of being flat, you start to drop. And back to Mari's question or point is that that drop is a continuous drop. It's not just a fatigue-related, you know, warble based on busy being busy, et cetera. And if it continues to drop over months, over years, you have an issue to deal with, because what's happening is you're having injuries in your brain that you're continually rewiring around, but that's causing the overall amount of your brain's ability to understand things is being reduced. And so
is it like a battery? You're losing juice?
That's a good way to think about it. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
And so as you lose juice, as you lose cognitive capacity, you can't tell, you feel completely normal. And so the whole point of the headset is to give you an objective measurement to say, hey, you're starting to go down. If you can catch it early enough, based on a recent publication in the Lancet Journal, up to 40% of people could avoid or significantly delay dementia. And so we can't help everybody, but if you can catch it early enough, the things that are going to help you are lifestyle changes. And so when it comes to, you know, people doing things for their brain, the simplest version is do things that you cannot do now. So push your brain to its capacity. If you're doing a Sudoku and you're great at Sudokus, then stop doing them or time yourself or do something that you can't do right now. But the big things are, if it's healthy for your body, it's healthy for your brain. So exercise, you know, sleep better, eat a modified Mediterranean diet or an analogous diet, be social, challenge your brain. Don't smoke, manage blood pressure, manage diabetes, manage your air quality that you breathe, have fun, get outside. You know, these are all things that we know about, but if we're not measuring our brain, we don't understand that we need to do more of these things to maintain, you know, maintain who we are.
So Nolan, if I'm to understand then that this is more a monitoring and detection system, or do you have some a treatment or training programs, or is that where you're going by any chance?
We provide the measurement fidelity for clinicians to understand what to do about the data. So okay. We work with GPs. We are not the psychiatrists or the general practitioners or the neurologists. But we work with them to help them understand who they're helping.
Okay. And I know we're hopping around a little bit, but I understood that your primary actual market or market of interest is first responders.
Yeah, it's first responders, allied health professionals, and military.
Okay.
And so what the people we want to help for our initial run at the market is the people who have a problem that is painful enough that they need to do something on a regular basis. If I told you you might have dementia 20 years from now, measure your brain every week, nobody's going to measure their brain every week. Not unless the measurement is just, amazingly fun, which it's not, right? It's something that you have to focus on. It takes 8 minutes. So these people who have more of a challenge we need to understand, because things for them, they might go on a call, see something that is terrifying, and not be themselves. And we can see that change right away because they'll drop below their baseline and they won't come back up. And so the issue is, well, you're below your baseline. You are at 10% of your best brain capacity. You are basically functionally impaired. You need to do something about it.
So is it potentially an institutional tool, or is it a wellness monitoring product?
I would position it more as an institutional tool.
Okay.
Like another study that we're doing that we're just putting together right now is we're working with operating room teams, so from the nurses to the surgeons to the anesthesiologists, to understand how the brain performance of the whole OR team relates to surgery outcomes and patient recorded outcomes. So we're kind of linking the whole process of healthcare in terms of, like, how is the brains of the people that are doing the healthcare related to the actual effectiveness of healthcare, and how engaged they are in their job, because healthcare is, as you know, very challenging.
Are you and your company finally going to be the ones who move these idiotic 24-hour shifts by proving that nobody should be working in hour 13 afterwards?
You know, it's funny you
Please.
say that, Mari, because I had a conversation with a fire chief just this past week, 2 days ago, and their union members, the firefighters, have said we want to move to 24-hour shifts, because what they do is they do 2 day and they do two night. And the problem is switching to two night is almost impossible, because they end up being awake for 24 hours anyway. So they said, give us a 24-hour day shift, a day off, a 24-hour day shift, a day off, and then we'll go off. But as you know, if you're in a busy city, you're going to be working straight on really, challenging physical and mental calls, and for 24 hours straight. You're not going to get a second of a break. You're going to be going from one to the next, and it's going to be, trauma after trauma after trauma. And so he said, well, we're going to do this now, but if we're measuring people's brains, maybe they might give us an answer we don't want. And that's a real, that's a, I hear that sometimes they just don't want to know. And so we just have to find out where the need to know is greater than the desire not to change.
I love this as potentially a different type of institutional tool, but just digressing a little bit with your permission,
Sure.
changing from two on, two off with a day in the middle versus a 24-hour. I mean, same problem, different angle. I don't know whether we want to digress a little bit, but I think you should have night shift and day shift, period.
Yeah, I would agree with you that that would be the best
Adapt,
way to do it. Yeah.
and change it every 6 months or so.
Exactly. And that change should come with an understanding that there's going to be some really tired people. So to manage that change in a way where you're not forcing them to basically be awake for multiple days on end as their circadian rhythms start to try and catch up.
So all the institutions out there, listen to this, please.
It may be more interesting for the firefighter union to get it than the management. That you can end up showing the problem from to people that want to see the problem.
100%, Jay, and that's what we're hearing, is that when we're doing this, it's a conversation with the chief, it's a conversation with the wellness person, it's a conversation with the union. And we have to make sure that it fits all of their needs, their worries, and their deliverables. And it is a little bit of a nuanced conversation we're finding. But often we have, if we have a strong enough champion in one of those, we can sort of find a way that it fits with everybody else.
Nice.
Denertification break.
Okay.
I'm a copper in Chicago.
Yes.
Looked over your website, and it sounds like you're addressing PTSD. We
Yeah.
didn't say the term, but it sounds like it. you know, trauma. I'm a copper. I don't get paid a lot of money, but $1,000, this can, this appears to be able to help me out. I'm a copper. Can you explain how this will help me?
Yeah. So first of all, we're not going to charge the copper, as you say. We're going to charge the organization that the cop works for. And there, the cop's going to use it as a way to, you know, manage his or her brain better. And so the whole point of it is, if we can see you dropping, is we need to do something about it before you end up to a state where you can't function. And what we see with cops, I mean, first responders in general, is hypervigilance. And hypervigilance is a really good proxy for measuring PTSD. The measurement we use does work for PTSD as well, but we're finding that hypervigilance is something that you can't turn off. And so it not only impacts their ability to do their work effectively, because they're over responding to stimuli that they shouldn't be. The other thing is they go home and they're over responding to everything. And so their family life is falling apart. They're exhausted. They're emotionally challenged from work. They're emotionally challenged from home. And so we need to find a way to see, hey, this person is in this state right now.
Got it.
And they're not saying anything, but we're measuring it. And so they need a way to sort of start dealing with this with the people that are going to help them. And needs to be visible. So the whole, the denotification of this is we're making the challenges with your brain visible for the first time ever.
I think I got it, Jay. Hold on. I think I got it. Tonight is the NFL draft. Okay. Professional football players, they got sensors all over the shoulder pads, their heads, you know, G forces on the heads. How fast are they going? And if they are taking too much damage, at least they can get a clue about it. Sounds to me like this product would be like similar, except for first responders to see that, you know, the juice, the brain is being too active, and the prediction of impairment in the future could happen. Am I looking at it the right way?
Yeah, nailed it. Yeah, exactly.
Boom. All right.
So, I mean, the simple version is if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And especially with our brain, we have no idea how our brain health is. We just don't have the ability to measure that. Sorry,
so measuring chronic stress, potentially chronic fatigue, and PTSD as your little big diagnosis in there. Nice.
Yeah.
So as people suffer trauma and start to have PTSD symptoms, the amygdala ends up having an emotional charge in it. It changes the thalamic gating, and your event-related potential, P100, arrives early and large. And in the raw EEG, we see repetitive lambda with visual hypervigilance. And that's a marker in PTSD and significant anxiety. And we see that in the raw EEG, but we see it in the ERP as well. And if you do a component analysis of the ERP, the arrival of the visual signal, the P100 wave ends up being, if you have norms, it's early and big. And it's the nervous system being jumpy from having that emotional charge.
Yeah.
And a little stimulus, you can get the person right off the floor, you know. So that's trackable with the ERP and the EEG. The eyes open EEG shows lambda repetitively, and in the spectrate, it ruins the low frequency because of the periodic waveform of the ERP arrival. And anyway, the EEG and ERP tracking of that for a significant burnout would be quite effective.
Pardon the other thing, Jay. The other thing, Jay, that we've seen, which is I found personally fascinating, is that if you're looking at the P300 waveform as well, what you would expect to see in a normal person is that their control stimulus is a more or less flat line. Their brain doesn't do much at the control point, and we see a nice amplitude spike based on the oddball stimulus or the infrequent stimulus. What happens when we see people with hypervigilance is both the control and the oddball spike, and when they shouldn't, right? We should only see it. So they're responding to the control. They're hyper responding to the control every single time, in addition to the P100 changes.
So the mismatch negativity ends up not having much difference.
That's right. And then you can, when you're measuring the difference between them, which would typically be seen as sort of cognitive fatigue, they're less. So what we have to do is we have to build a virtual baseline for that amplitude spike and then measure both peaks as they would correlate with it or as they would relate to it as a measure of hypervigilance and overall fatigue.
In fact, Yuri Kropotkov has shown that the mismatch negativity is linearly related to attention.
Well, that's another thing that we're measuring, which I found fascinating is that so and Pete, I know right now you're probably rolling your eyes at us. I apologize, but Jay's got some really interesting points. And I guess this is sort of targeted to a smaller and smaller audience when we get super esoteric. But what we're seeing, which I find very interesting, is we qualify the response of your brain's ability to understand information on a trial-by-trial basis. And what we're seeing with people who are hyper-fatigued, who have chronic burnout or have PTSD is that their ability to pay attention to all the stimulus gets drastically less. And so they're seeing the information, but they're not processing the information. And we've seen some people that are only processing about 12% of the information that we're sending their brain. And so you can imagine if you're a police officer and you're wandering around the world having to make decisions about what the information is coming into your brain, you're not even seeing or paying attention to the vast majority of it because your brain is so overdone. And
I'm going to
this is
jump in
why.
and help Pete a little bit. but one of the things I think that we prize our first responders on is appearing cool, calm, and collected. Now, I would say that that control of expression is very, very important in terms of assisting individuals. But potentially, what I see in terms of your product is the ability to differentiate between self-control trained in to give comfort in situations versus an individual who isn't present enough. Because I would say to coworkers or other first responders on the job, and perhaps even to the individuals being assisted, to the naked eye, we would not be able to tell the difference. Would you agree with that?
Totally agree. And the other thing I would add to it is that if you're looking at somebody who is paying attention and their eyes are open and they're focused on the right thing, there's two things that we can think about. One, how much of the information are they actually processing? And two, how much of their brain has the ability to process that information? So do they have the capacity to make a good decision based on their training, their skill set, and their intelligence? And if they have these issues that we've been talking about, both of those things are significantly reduced. And like you say, Mari, it's not visible. You can't see it, and they can't see it in themselves either.
Yeah, if they're well trained, yeah. So that there's your catch 22.
Yeah, exactly.
De-geeked enough, Pete?
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. I'm not. Look, I'm the thumbnail guy, so I got to put this into a format where somebody's going to actually click on it and watch and. I'm trying to figure out how my mom would buy it, the first responders. If it's not the first responders, then it's the higher ups. And in the States, there's less budget on mental health than it is in Canada. Is that a fair statement, the two Canadians in the audience?
I don't know what the state budget is on mental health, but I know in Canada it's a huge focus right now.
Because we've had Ruth Lanius on. She's a fellow Canadian, and we talk about PTSD and my perception is that Canada is more on the ball, not as much as Europe. Europe seems to be really
Oh,
ahead
yeah.
of things. But the US, it's God, it's like politics. None of this really matters until it affects you personally, right? And it takes 30, decades for this stuff to deteriorate your juice. People won't pay attention. If people aren't paying attention, look, they're not voting. Okay, the voting turnout is horrible. So unless something like really okay, you get fired up with Trump and Biden, that'll set off your measurement device there.
Pete, I'm going to throw in the money issue, right?
Go.
If you can essentially, if you have a product that goes out and says you can catch things before a fire, excuse me, and save money so that you don't have to pay healthcare, et cetera, I mean, for better for worse, it's an angle that people listen to. So in terms of preventative, what we're talking about is potentially cost saving. Now, before I go too far in my other thought. This is where my rant is starting, Nolan. I'm kind of known for my mini rants here.
Oh.
But I kind of take issue. Like, PTSD is driving me crazy. Everybody and your grandmother, Pete, is being diagnosed now with PTSD. And I assume, Nolan, that your market is the, you know, the more industrial market, et cetera, but you know, maybe, you know, a device like yours could also be used to really differentiate somebody who's had
Yes.
a negative event or a few negative events versus when it really affects the functioning of the person. I get really pissed off at how we're over-diagnosing standard life as opposed to a horrendous life events. So if anyone wants to pick up my rant here, here,
I'll pick it up, Mari, because I think it's a brilliant point. And I completely agree. So I think one of the things that the ability to capture these data sets at scale will allow us to do is to start to stratify the different, you know, types and severities that disease takes. So PTSD is an excellent one. If you're going to have PTSD, there is a whole bunch of different levels of severity that happen within that, in terms of how somebody can function, how their brain's working, what part of their brain is changed. Same thing with dementia. Dementia is a broad term for a whole bunch of things that are limiting your brain's ability to think as you get older. And so as we can collect data at scale and start to collect, you know, as Jay said, you know, maybe 500,000, maybe, you know, million data sets, we'll start to figure out that this type of brain activity is related to these types of conditions, and these types of solutions are effective for those people. The short answer is this is a data plate to understand how things work. And by being able to capture brainwaves at this, you know, sort of population-based level will allow us to figure this out. And last point I'll make, slightly geeky, goes back to one of Jay's initial points, is that the one challenge with the EEG is if you collect the data with a different type of headset, the data is hard to mesh with another data set because the electrodes are in the same place, the impedances are different, the post-processing, the analog digital converters, you know, for all these reasons, the data is tricky to mesh. And so it's kind of like the beta VHS thing is you kind of have to have one version win, and then we'll all just sort of use that data set to figure out, you know, how the gold standard relates to brain activity in the various ways it can.
Yeah. In the event-related potential world, all you have to do is change one little thing. You know, if you're sitting in front of a computer screen and the degrees of radius of the image change, the luminosity of the screen changes, the interstimulus interval changes, anything like that will change your P300.
Yeah.
And so P300 was declared unreliable by the medical world, but that's only between labs. Within a lab, it's extraordinarily reliable.
Exactly right.
And
yeah.
You know, to the point where Yuri Kropotov has normative database of ERPs, and so do the Koreans, with like five different kinds of ERP stimulus. On yours, are you using like a flash VEP or checkerboard or visual stimulus or
it's oddball? Triggers? It's the oddball task.
Oddball, yeah. Auditory, visual.
We're not doing auditory yet. We've obviously thought about it because it's fairly easy to do. But we're just doing visual oddballs. So it's just you'll see a circle of one color, and then every once in a while you'll see a circle of a different color, and that stimulates that you know, evoke response.
Yeah, like an IVA or a TOVA, basically, that a stimulus you, but you're not requiring them to make a response. So it's not like a go no go test. You're just looking for
it's not a go no go test. However, we do get them to tap the screen every time they see an oddball to help them focus. That doesn't matter for your brain function in terms of the measurements that we do, but we want them to pay attention to the screen, so we gamify it.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, when we use it on athletes, they are actually, you know, even firefighters, they're so competitive. So the tapping helps.
One thing I'm just going to throw in, because we, until recently, it's never really been mentioned, so I bring it up a lot. Anything you're aware of in terms of gender? Now, I know still many of our forces are male dominant, but anything that you'd like to share in terms of that?
Sure, a few things. So Your biological sex at birth does change the physiology of your brain. So when we do our studies, we do ask for your biological sex at birth, not your identified gender. The other thing that we've been asked to look at is how women's brain change pre and during and post-menopause, which has been very interesting. We haven't looked at it yet, but it's on our list of things that are of interest to us. I mean, essentially, I think that having better visibility of how people's brains are changing across gender lines, across all the different aspects that humans can be humans, is fascinating. So we do want to do these things, but we have to be strategic about how we start. And we haven't seen anything in the data that shows a marked difference between the genders at this point.
That's interesting because Jay and I have been yapping a bit about this in terms of slightly premenopausal, not quite perimenopausal, but definitely postmenopausal females. The high beta, which can be a vigilance measure, is higher naturally versus males. After a certain age, it goes down. So that could be really, really interesting in terms of your measurements. And any thoughts on that, or is this interesting things potentially to come?
There is to come. We do measure those things. So because our data, it all runs through our back end, cloud-based analysis, we're constantly re-evaluating our data set to figure new things out. Because we do expect to look at those types of questions, but that's to come, certainly.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
The Koreans have a nice normative database coming up around 2,000 people separating males and females. And at about age 40, 45, males have a tendency to drop in the beta and gamma range, and females light up like somebody just plugged them in.
Interesting.
And a dramatic difference from that age. And the databases that combine them, what I call a eunuch database, end up having lots of fast activity and not much. And so you get something you don't want to be compared to. Females don't want to be compared to that average, and neither do males. I mean, you've got to have a sex-specific norm. And intuitively, I knew that there was a difference, and urged the Koreans who got a government grant to collect their norms to separate the sexes. And I told them it was going to take them twice as long, twice as much work and everything, but it was the right thing to do. And that's what they did. It was the first time anybody had the ability with large data sets, age corrected norms and sex corrected norms, to look at the differences. There's also a dramatic difference during the developmental trajectory from, 1 to 10. The females and males have developmental surges at different ages. So you end up seeing various components within the EEG that end up differentiating male and female extremely well. And they've actually started to look at people undergoing hormonal replacement during gender identification changes, going from female to male, and they've got a data set on that. It's not a big enough data set yet, but they're looking to see kind of how that changes. Actually, a colleague in San Francisco has spearheaded that and is doing the data collection on individuals that she knows. So anyway, it's a big world out there with lots of interesting applications, and it sounds like your headset's going to be an interesting assessment and a warning system. It doesn't have the feedback end of it as a treatment end, from what it sounds like.
So it's a good point, Jay. So just to hop in there real quick, one of the things we're doing with clinicians is we're linking our data to the health data in an EMR of their patients. And we're doing that to understand how does the things we're seeing in your brain waves relate to your body health, and your body health changes over time and vice versa. And that's to help understand, how things in your body influence your brain and vice versa. And so I think that will allow us to start to figure out if we're seeing these changes related to development and all the things that you can measure, how do they function and relate to human health?
Many years ago, Anna Weiss, who's passed many years ago now, had a matrix with brain arousal on one axis and body arousal measured as the electrodermal potential on the other, GSR, old term. And high body arousal, low brain arousal, high brain arousal, low body arousal, very different cognitive states. So tracking body and brain. I mean, we aren't disembodied brains
Exactly.
as much as some of the neurofeedback world think that way. You've got to take into account the body as well. And
Well, and I think it goes back to one of Mari's points, which is we really need to understand more of a personalized understanding, both in terms of what the disease state is, but what different people's brains are. Like, how is your brain function versus mine versus Mari's versus Pete's, et cetera? And I think getting the sort of norms for the J's of the population versus me versus somebody else will help you understand who you are at a different level.
So
Just
you
like.
came into this from a very interesting perspective with deep neuroanatomical, neurochemical assessments from lower animals, but there's a lot of extrapolation to, human brain from lower animals. We share some of the same structures,
100%.
perhaps not the same amount of frontal lobe. We swell with pride because we've got a big frontal lobe,
Oh, here we go.
But the Mac monkey's got pretty much everything we've got except for a little bit of frontal ballast, and
But does all that extra gray matter make us happier?
only if you use it
Compared to
right.
what?
It just gives us flat heads.
Just give them big bald heads.
If you want to see an impressive brain, look at a dolphin.
I agree, yeah. Well, that's what I'm wondering is if you're looking at other animals and the lives they lead, they don't have the same security and they don't live in these sort of electrified dead environments, but are we happier than they are on average? I would be curious if we could, sort of quantify that in some way.
Goldfish.
Every few
Round and
seconds
round
they're
and
happy.
round they go.
Dr. Nolan Bisey. Did I say that right, Dr. Nolan Bisey?
We have nailed it multiple times in a row now,
Thank you.
yeah.
I got Dr. Marie staring right at me. It makes me nervous.
Wow.
All right, my mom threw away her puzzle books, and my copper buddies are interested. Where do we send them to find more information about your product and your service?
They can reach us through their website or they can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm more than always happy to chat.
And these coppers that are driving in their car, they're like, well, what's the website?
It's circlebrain.com.
Circlebrain.
CIRCL.
CL. Okay, got it. Got it.
So it's circle without the E on the end and then brain.com.
Got it.
Is there puns without the E there somewhere? I don't know whether we're still recording here, Pete, but
We are.
Nolan, I want to just throw out an open invitation because we're just I'm the clinic is here in Vancouver, so anytime you're
Oh,
in town
perfect.
and want to show off your come in and show off your product, please come on in. Very
Yeah,
interesting.
I'll come by. I'll be there in the next few weeks, so I'll message you.
Okay, great, thanks.
Do you consider Dr. Maria Westsider then?
Yeah.
Aren't you in Vancouver?
No, I
Oh,
live.
Dr. Marie's in Vancouver, aren't you?
Yes.
And
I'm
you're
in downtown
Toronto, and that's
Vancouver.
east, right?
No, my training and I lived for Toronto for 9 years, but I live on the one of the most western parts of all of Canada. So I live in Souk out of Victoria, which is the southwestern edge of Vancouver Island in the forest where I go, free diving in the ocean right next to me. So I live in the middle of nowhere.
But he's just a little ferry ride away from the big city.
That's right. I go to Vancouver regularly.
Years ago, I built a house out in the woods. It took me 12 years. It was a three-story house so I could get solar collection up high up at, above the trees. And I lived there after I built it for about 3 years. But the doctors up there couldn't keep me alive. I had to sell the house and move back down to the
Oh,
Bay
that's
Area.
unfortunate.
So
Yeah.
it's a I envy your ability to have a good life out in nature.
Who
Quite
you kidding, Jay?
a
You're the
blessing.
mayor of Sioux Sun City.
All
Dr. Nolan
right.
Bicey, thank you for coming on the NeuroNoodle podcast. Thank you for denerdifying things so I can understand them. Because I'm a sales guy, you're an engineer guy. You know, we don't get along, but now we do. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, have a great weekend.
Okay, you too.
The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you.